Hello, I'm Susan Carland, and welcome to Assumptions, a series in which we discover why jumping to conclusions might be bad for your health. Because you know what? Maybe it's time to ditch some of your out-of-date assumptions, like that smoking keeps you slim, or that red wine is the elixir of life, or that sharing an inspirational quote on social media makes you an enlightened person, even if you add hashtag blessed. In today's myth-busting quest, we take a look at a high-flying job still dominated by men.
I was saying goodbye to the passengers one day, and there was an older chap who, as he was leaving the aircraft, just looked at me and said, if I knew it was a female pilot, I wouldn't have got on.
And so you poo-pooed colonic irrigation and you're not keen on quinoa? Are health fads just a sick joke?
This is a classic thing in biology, and we make this mistake all the time, that if something is good for us, then more of something must be better for us.
But before we get into overdosing on goodness, we're going to talk about something we all know to be bad. Trolls. Not those loathsome little creatures from fairy tales, but real modern-day internet bullies who hide behind their keyboards and dish out anonymous nastiness. Here's a few examples from Twitter for you.
Kirsty Alley is a dirty whore. What the f*** is up with Amy Poehler's face? Bitch looks like she survived a nuclear blast. Susan Carland, filthy traitor c***. Why are you still in Australia? Go and live with your black pets in their diversity utopia of Africa.
In fact, that last one was all for me. Lucky me. As a Muslim woman living in Australia, I've attracted my fair share of trolls. It's okay to assume that they're just awful people, right? But what if they actually just want, dare I say it, some love? Joining me to discuss this is Laura DeMarcy, social researcher and director at global research firm Ipsos and Troll Whisperer. Laura, thank you for joining me. Trolls are just awful people, aren't they?
You know, it's tempting to kind of simplify it in that way. It would be a lot easier just to say, oh, they're just all horrible and, you know, let's all move on. But I think it's a lot more complex than that. I think, firstly, the most important thing to remember is that we're talking about a really small number of people here. The impact they have is highly disproportionate to the volume of them that are out there. So it only takes a handful of nasty people to make, you know, to say a few things such as the tweet that you received, which is pretty horrendous, to make people feel like we're kind of being overrun by trolls. And, you know, in reality, it's a really small number of people. What drives people to kind of do and say these things, which are really controversial and sometimes downright hideous, is usually a kind of craving for attention.
So do you think deep down they're just insecure people that are looking for affirmation, even love?
Oh, absolutely. So we did a study of this group. So I should say initially we weren't looking at trolls. We're looking at the people who are most active on social media. So the kind of loudest voices online, those that are dominating the conversation.
Those that type in all caps.
Yeah, yes. Those people that are, you know, checking in when they're out and about, the people tweeting from events, the people tweeting when they're watching TV, that kind of thing. So this is where you will find the trolls within this group. And what they're really looking for is acknowledgement, you know, validation. They just want to be heard. You've got to say something controversial, otherwise no one hears you and you don't stand out. It's psychological profile. It's the kind of person that's always looking for validation.
Why do it in such a toxic way?
Look, the sad fact is that some people have these opinions. And I think that the reasonable people out there amongst us forget that. If you were to elicit these opinions from these people in the real world, you'd probably find they wouldn't dare open their mouths. The thing that brings these guys out of the woodworks is that there's so much protection offered to them in the online world. It's anonymous. People who, you know, may never say these things in the real world are emboldened once they step behind the screen and kind of live out these fantasies. And these kind of horrible opinions that they may have had, they feel like it's safe for them to express them because there's no consequence, or they're really disconnected from the consequences. Yes, there's a consequence because there's someone on the receiving end of that, and you know how that feels. But within the context of the online world and online communication, we're completely disconnected from the consequences until, you know, you read in the paper and someone might have committed self-harm because of what's happened to them. And that's a reality check. And hopefully that scares these types of people and, you know, makes them kind of stop.
When someone threatens physical harm or even makes death threats, is that still trolling?
I think it's interesting. I think when most people say trolling, they're not talking about people making death threats. And I think that's probably another category.
There was a famous case of one woman, a writer called Lindy West, who confronted one of the worst trolls she'd ever had. And it was a man who created a fake Twitter account of Lindy West's dead father just to upset her. What's interesting is this troll started to show remorse and he emailed Lindy and he said, "I don't know why or even when I started trolling you. I think my anger at you stems from your happiness with your own being. It served to highlight my unhappiness with myself." How representative do you think that sentiment would be of other trolls?
Yeah, that's really interesting. When I met some of these people, they sort of just upon first meeting fell into two kind of groups. So the first one was the really outwardly confident type person. But the other half, which was really shocking to me, was that it was completely opposite to the online persona. So these people were really socially awkward, really shy. Some of them couldn't look you in the eye. Some of them could hardly talk. I think the reason why they're so attracted to the online world and that in that context is because they can be brave and they can be bold and they do things that they just can't do in real life. A lot of them did not strike me as particularly happy people, so I'm not surprised about that. And you know, if you're unhappy and you're lonely, these are the people that are more likely to sit online all night because they've got nothing else to do.
Yeah. It's hard to have empathy for people who seem to be not just cruel, but take delight in being cruel to other people. Mm. But from what you've said, it sounds like it might be important that we have empathy for them.
You probably don't need to have empathy if you don't want to, because some of them don't deserve it. But I think it helps in understanding their motivation and that helps free you and me and anyone else who has to deal with these type of people regularly. Because you realise that it's just, you know, it's like a cry for attention. It's the three-year-old having the tantrum in the shopping centre.
It's one thing to think about trolls who say pointless, nasty things online. But what about when there is this belief that people are actually doing the right thing? There's this phenomenon we're seeing growing on social media. It's something of a pile-on where someone might tweet or write something on Facebook that is a bit stupid or a bit thoughtless or a bit insensitive, and there's this massive moral outrage and thousands of people raise their virtual pitchforks and they pursue this culprit relentlessly and publicly for their stupidity. How does that relate to trolling?
I think what you're describing there in this sort of phenomenon is, you know, the new self-righteous mob. And social media is the most perfect mechanism or tool to give rise to this new kind of phenomena, which would really not have existed in, you know, a decade ago. I don't know. I'm pretty sure that most people wouldn't say that it was trolling because they feel justified and they feel legitimate because the opinion or the stance they're taking in their mind is moral and it's legitimate and it's ethical. The big problem is that the online context is seriously disconnected from reality. So whilst those people get a thrill because they become part of a community of self-righteous others, the consequences of that are so disconnected from their lives that they kind of, it's like a frenzy develops. And the end result of that is just not on their minds. The person on the other end is dehumanized. So I think people just get wrapped up. The problem with online communication is that it's just so damn easy and sort of so reflexive that there's no time for self-censorship or for people to stop and think about what they're doing. It's so easy to click like. It's so easy to become part of a mob that, you know, upon reflection, I'm sure many people would think, actually, maybe I shouldn't have done that.
It sounds like in that situation then, the intention might be different to the classical troll, but the outcome can be just the same.
That's right. That's exactly right. Yeah.
It's funny. I have a standard response that I give to my trolls when I get them on Twitter, which is they say something ghastly to me. And my response is always, "It sounds like someone needs a hug." And it's a really fun one to do because it does, you know, sort of validate what you're saying. But it also shows I'm not taking this seriously. I'm not going to let it upset me. And there
what
is nowhere there is nowhere to go. There is nowhere for them to go
That's
from that.
Right.
Sometimes they're like, I don't want to be hugged by a disgusting Muslim like you. But often they just fall silent because it's totally diffused the situation.
Yeah.
But it still responded. So they have got that acknowledgement that they need because, as you said, it's like dealing with a toddler. And so what did my toddler need in a tantrum? It needed mum to come up and go, come on.
Yeah,
I know you're a bit overwhelmed.
and
maybe
true.
I should get out my copy of Toddler Taming to deal with my online trolls.
Yeah, exactly. We can adapt it to troll taming. Just adapt.
I think we're onto something.
Yeah.
let's write this book offline. Laura, this has been absolutely fascinating and a little bit alarming. I'm very grateful to you for joining me. Thank you for coming.
Thank you so much for having me, and good luck with that horrible troll of yours. Keep cuddling, and I'm sure they'll disappear.
Everybody cuddle. Hashtag cuddle. My guest was Laura DeMarcy, social researcher, director at global research firm Ipsos and Troll Whisperer, and you are listening to Assumptions on RN. I'm Susan Carland. Something a little healthier. These days, health fads come and go faster than you can say activated almonds. Dr. Google is the Jekyll and Hyde of modern medicine. Sensible one second, horror story the next. And with so much good, bad, and ugly health advice in the air, it's no wonder there are many of us who are self-medicating. Here to diagnose our health assumptions is Rod Lamberts from the Australian National Centre for Public Awareness of Science. Rod, we are going to be like kids high on sugar and whiz through a grab bag of common health beliefs. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I'll speak as quickly as possible.
All right. Health assumption number one, we need 8 glasses of water a day.
No. If you do the maths on the basic amount of water 8 glasses would be, you're talking about 2.5 litres of water or something?
Yeah, it's a lot. It's a lot.
And apparently if we're sweating buckets, I think is the quote, you only need about 1.2 litres of water.
If there's no evidence for this, how did it become so commonplace? Where did this come from?
It's got a level of truthiness to it. It makes sense. Water's so pure, you know, it flushes things, it cleans things. I think that's a lot to do with it.
So is there a minimum amount that we should be trying to have, or is it just a drink when you're thirsty?
Trust in your body is something I'm seeing come up a lot more lately in all kinds of health advice.
Next one, we need to detox.
Yeah. Look, no, we don't. There are so many different ways. You know, there are people, they take the ginseng diet or they don't eat any solid foods for 12 days, 14 days. I'm going to do a liver cleanse.
That's
you hear a lot of those.
A lot of lemons involved.
Yes, yes. A lot of lemons, a lot of water, not much else. And it turns out that that really doesn't have a lot of effect. And I'm not surprised to hear this, you know. The body is designed to break down toxins. We have all kinds of mechanisms that are very good at that. You know, that's what they're for. Kidneys, liver, digestive systems, etc. suck the bad stuff out and help us get it out via various antisocial practices that we all have to engage in. Look, the other thing I think is interesting too is most of the stuff that you'd really want to get rid of can apparently take 10 years to ditch from your body anyway.
Also,
so a 30-day fast is going to do absolutely nothing.
Yes, okay. That's depressing, if nothing else. I remember reading that, in fact, there were no randomised controlled trials to put this issue beyond doubt, and that there was no proof that detox works better than a placebo. So, again, I wonder if this is something that we are just projecting on wanting to say, oh, I suddenly felt so good after 5 days and my skin was clearer and I could, you know, I could see my chakras. And I do wonder if it's just about wanting
that help. I think there's a worthiness thing here, you know. If you suffered, you feel like you're worthy of more. It seems to me the people who are very into detox diets, you know, their necks get a little longer and they walk a bit taller because they've made the effort to punish themselves a little bit.
Puritanical high.
Yeah. And look, the upside of that, though, is if it's forcing you to pay more attention to your diet in general, maybe that's a good thing, like an incidental effect.
So people do this to be healthy, but is there any chance that the opposite could be true and this could ever, in fact, be harmful?
Yeah, there is this implication that in some research with rapid weight loss and so on, you suddenly release a bunch of chemicals that wouldn't be normally in such concentrations in your body, and that could be a problem.
Right. Now, Rod, I don't know about you, but I do like to live like a Neanderthal from 10,000 years ago, especially in my eating.
This is a really big one at the moment, the paleo diet that we should all be living like and eating more specifically like cavemen, because that's when our evolution stopped, is the argument. Evolutionarily, we haven't really evolved much past the caveman stomach, and so we need to be eating like they did then.
Yeah, except we have a bit. We have evolved a bit. We are better at digesting starches and lactose and things than we used to be, for starters.
Right.
Also, it's a strange attitude, and I hear this a lot too, this idea that there was a pinnacle of evolution somewhere. It was always in the past. We're never heading towards it. We've always passed it for some reason. And for some reason, it was when we were cave types between, 10 and 50,000 years ago, anywhere, depending on who you ask.
Right.
It just doesn't seem to hold water at all. Bear fruit? What would you call it?
Well, bear, organic, 10,000-year-old fruit.
Yes, that's it. So definitely organic. I mean, we could say that safely. They would have been eating organic.
Yeah. Okay. Vitamin pills are good and useful for us, especially when our dietary intake is not adequate.
This is a classic thing in biology, and we make this mistake all the time, intelligent people, silly people, and everyone in between, that if something is good for us, then more of something must be better for us.
Mm-hmm.
And biology on the whole works with optimum levels of things, not maximum levels of things. So
that's an important distinction.
It's hugely important. And I think this is a mistake we make in these fad diets and popular supplements and trends all the time. X is good, so X times 3 must be even better. And I think this is what's going on with vitamins quite a bit, of all kinds. And I mean, have you ever taken a whole bunch of vitamin C, for example? There's a way of taking it in powder form that if you have a lot of that, you need to make sure you're never more than about 5 steps from a bathroom.
Well, that's a confronting image, and one that actually takes us neatly into our next assumption. This one, the assumption that urine in a swimming pool, you know, the public pool that we all go to, makes the chlorine smell stronger.
Well, apparently urine and other contaminants, as I put, icky things our bodies bring in, binds with chlorine, and you get these chloramines, I think I'm pronouncing it correctly, chloramines.
Yep.
And they're the things that stink. So that's sort of like the chlorine doing its job, mopping stuff up. It's the result of chlorine acting on these nasties that seems to be what's going on there. And that's what the strongest smell is.
So if we go to the pool and it smells really strong, that means it could be because it's got a high amount of urine or other things on the body, perspiration,
urine
cosmetics.
And other.
Right. What I'm gathering from all of these assumptions that we're making is that we're all trying to do the right thing. You know, we're having a lot of vitamin tablets, we're drinking a lot of water, we're trying to eat like, you know, cavemen did, we're going swimming, God love us. But some of these are dangerous. So how can we tell what's true?
What seems to me more and more important is we seem to be looking for quick fixes, you know. We're looking for easy answers to problems. We're looking for quick fixes and solutions to them. And a lot of these trends and fads, I think, are related to that very reasonable desire. You know, if you want to maximize your antioxidants and if you want good vitamin intake and if you want to be healthy, eat well. And also try not to get sucked up in this whole worthiness thing.
We have run out of time for today. The guest joining us today has been Dr. Rod Lamberts, Deputy Director from the Australian National Centre for Public Awareness of Science. Everybody, please stop peeing in the pool.
Come fly with me, let's fly away.
And now, from finding your way around health fads to flying solo in a man's world, this is your captain speaking. And yes, your pilot is a woman. Do you have a problem with that? Assumptions producer Rachel Carbonell met with Claire Irving, a pilot with a big international airline company, for her perspective on gender assumptions at work.
Look, I always wanted to be a pilot when I was at school, but in those days, Deborah Wardley was just going through the whole battle with Reg Ansett. So females weren't actually in the airlines at that stage. So I went and did other things. And eventually, when she won the court case and women started to get jobs flying, I took myself off to Moorabbin Airport and, just started to learn to fly down there.
So you said that you had to do something else for a little while first. So you actually had to put your career ambition on the back burner until change happened in the industry.
I was really keen on horses at that stage when I left school. So I went and became a Jillaroo and worked on properties in New South Wales and Western Victoria. And then I became an air traffic controller, which was kind of the next best thing.
So once you completed your training, what was your first job?
Instructing. So it's a funny, it's a terrible system, really. So you've only just learned how to fly yourself, and to try and get your hours up, you turn around and teach other people. people when you don't really have very much experience yourself, but that's the way it is. After that, I was lucky enough to get a job with Hazelton Airlines in New South Wales, which is a rural-based airline. Max Hazelton, the boss there, is a fabulous chap, and I think he gave me the job there because I was an ex-Gillaroo, not because I was a pilot, and I could drive a tractor. So I think it did me in good stead to have that agricultural experience. So that was the first commercial work.
And what was your next job after that? And that's an international airline, so you fly domestically and internationally?
That's it. It's pretty much you're rated on one type of aircraft, and wherever that aircraft goes, that's where you go. And at the moment, it's mainly Southeast Asia and a lot of Perth flights.
You've been doing that for, what, about 20 years now?
25 years with this airline.
And do you still love the job?
I adore it. It's just, I get excited still driving to the airport. It's just fantastic.
Now, you said you were the 9th female pilot to come into the airline that you now work for. Mm. What was the dynamic like, I guess, in terms of gender when you first started? What was it like?
It was very difficult. I mean, there's guys that didn't want us there as females. There are other guys that were just fantastic. It was a big change for them to have females in the flight deck. So there was, adjustments on both sides needed to be made. And I've seen over the 25 years how things have changed. It wasn't that long ago when we just weren't wanted.
When you say there were men in the industry who just didn't want females there, why do you think there was that reticence to have women in the industry?
It's probably just such an unusual thing for them. And a lot of the chaps may have come from, World War II base with different backgrounds, I guess. And it was just really unusual for them to have to work in close proximity to females and in stressful situations, I guess.
It was a cultural, generational thing more than anything?
Yeah, I would have thought so. And look, you can certainly see it in so many other industries as well, not just ours. And ours is adapted to change, I think, a lot faster than some of the other terrible stories I hear from the legal profession and other industries.
When you first started and there was some antagonism from some of the men in the industry, what's an example of how that came across sometimes?
The industry was so different. The flight deck door was open, but all the captains and first officers were smoking cigarettes and drinking coffee and having the mixed grill for breakfast, and they're all having heart attacks when they were 50. And so, in those days, we were doing a 10-hour flight up to Tokyo, and when the flight attendant came up and asked for drinks, the captain and first officer are both, coffee and cigarettes, and I asked for a bottle of water, and the captain turned around and said, "We're not having any bottles of water up here. If you want to drink water, go down the back." Whereas now, on a Melbourne-Sydney flight, which is a 50-minute flight, it's mandatory for each pilot to have a bottle of water. So, look, the industry has completely changed.
And are there any relics of the past? Are there things that still bug you, that you still rail against at all?
Probably just the fact that I have to dress up like a man every day. We haven't quite got to skirts yet, which is unfortunate, and I still have to wear a tie, but look, that's a small price to pay for doing something that I love. I think the other unusual thing was the general populace's outlook as to a female pilot. I was saying goodbye to the passengers one day, and there was an older chap who, as he was leaving the aircraft, just looked at me and said, "If I knew it was a female pilot, I wouldn't have got on." So, it's there's some terrible opinions out there.
What was your reaction to that? Did you laugh or did you give him a greasy? How do you cope with that?
No, there's nothing you can say, really, is there? I mean, I jokingly say now I don't bother making a PA until the front door's closed, so no one can get off then.
And what other attitudes have you had from the airline travelling public?
Most generally, they're really good. I've had a beautiful, some beautiful notes sent up to me by some women, and especially one on Mother's Day that was just really gorgeous. People misinterpret you. I remember once, as I checked out as a captain, we were flying up to Hong Kong, and it was about an hour before we got to Hong Kong. And I went back to say hello to some of the passengers, and there was a South African woman travelling alone with two small kids. And she just looked at me, and I think she must have thought I was a flight attendant, because she just thrust her baby in my arms and said, "Can you hold this?" Well, I ended up holding the baby for like 15 minutes, and you always think of the good lines after, but I felt like saying, "Would you mind taking your baby back, because I have to go and land the plane." So, people misinterpret who you are. They just see a uniform, and I guess she thought I was a flight attendant.
When you say that you've had some lovely sentiments from people in the past, like, for example, a note that was passed up to you on Mother's Day, do you mind sharing with me what that note said?
I've got the notes, actually, in my office. I keep them.
Do you want to get it?
Do you want me to?
Oh, yeah, that'd be lovely. Are you sure you don't mind sharing it? does it say?
So, how wonderful to hear the voice of a female captain, my first time, on Mother's Day too. Thanks a lot, it means a lot. And then she signed her name.
That is so lovely. And so occasionally that happens, people pass their sentiments up.
Yeah, absolutely.
That was pilot Claire Irving talking with Rachel Carbonell about navigating the male-dominated airspace of commercial aviation. And that brings us to the end of this episode of Assumptions. I assume you're feeling better now after a healthy dose of scepticism. And by the way, another thing that's good for you with questionable evidence, staying connected with us. Keep in touch with us on Twitter, Facebook, or at the RN website. I'm Susan Carland. I look forward to meeting you here again next time to explore the rights and wrongs of jumping to conclusions.